Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Mark Hertzgard. I'm the environment correspondent and investigative editor at The Nation magazine, which is one of the media co-sponsors here. Thank you very much. And I'm also a contributor to KALW Public Radio, which is another media co-sponsor here today. And I want to just mention that this particular session, all the sessions at the Bay Area Book Festival are going to be podcast and available on the website. But this particular session will be also broadcast later on KALW, and you can look at our website, klw.org, for the specific time and date of that, and also, of course, the Book Festival website will have that as well. And this is the session, as you all know, on the book Drawdown with the creator and editor here to my right, Paul Hawken. And we're gonna introduce Paul again in a second. So that was a good start, but I want you to give him a little more love the second time around. But the first thing I want you all to do, please, is to make sure that your cell phones are turned off, or at least put them into airplane mode, as they say. And do remember, please, that this will be broadcast later on KALW. So we're having this conversation on June 3rd, 2017. And as you may have noticed, global warming has been in the news the last few days. Just 48 hours ago, President Donald Trump announced that he was withdrawing the United States from the Paris Accord on global warming. That's the international agreement that committed the world's nations to limit global warming well below 2 degrees C. That's the level that scientists warn could be incompatible with civilization as we know it. Of course, Mr. Trump's announcement thrilled his political base with its America First message, but it unleashed worldwide condemnation from government, business, and civil society leaders who said the United States president was ignoring science and betraying humanity's future, especially that of the world's most vulnerable people and the ecosystems of the world. But today's session, I want you to think of today's session as an antidote to the discouraging news of recent days. The title of the book that we're discussing hints at why I say that. I'm holding it up now, and I'll read it here for the benefit of those who can't see or who are listening on the air. Drawdown, subtitle, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, edited by Paul Hawken. Everyone who can hear my voice here in the venue today and on the air later, I want you to buy this book. I hope you will read this book. I hope you will treat this book as if your life depends upon it, because it does. And my life depends upon it, and my 12-year-old daughter's life depends upon it, and everyone on this planet's life depends upon the solutions that are in this book. We have got to solve this problem if we want our civilization and our children and our children's children to have the lives that they deserve. And the very strong message of this book is that we can solve this problem. And in fact, we already are. To hear more about that, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to the creator and editor of this book, Paul Hawken. I think they like you, Paul.
I like you too, Mark. I'm going to keep that recording.
So can we just dive right in here?
Yeah, let's go in.
The title, you know, I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of books on global warming. Your title has a very interesting, subtitle really, has a very interesting verb in it, reverse.
Yes.
Not stop, not fight, not talk about reverse global warming. Why was that important?
Well, as you know, the language around climate change has been about reduction, about mitigation has really been the prime word. It's in the Article 2 of the UN Framework Conference on Climate Change. And Article 2 says the objective of the IPCC is to mitigate climate change so as to ensure stable food supplies for the world. And the reason, and I'm going to show a slide here. I know we're on radio, but just so quickly, the reason that just didn't make sense to me was this here. And if you look at CO2 emissions over the last 400 years, humans, actually for the last 4 million years, human beings have never lived here over 300 ppm until 1940. And the last time they were 285, prior to that, was the Eemian period, 125,000 years ago. And at that time, the waters in the ocean were 20 to 30 feet higher, depending on where in the globe. And there was crocodiles and hippopotamus in the Thames River Delta. There was alligators in Alaska. There was lions and giraffes romping across the fields of Germany. I mean, it was a very different regime than we have today. That's 285 ppm, and we're at 402 if we don't count methane, nitrous oxide, and chlorofluorocarbons and hydrofluorocarbons. So we're more like 448 ppm in CO2 equivalents. And so the idea of mitigation, reduction, you know, stabilization, to me seems kind of absurd and kind of weak as a goal. And when you see that line there, that straight up line, the only thing that made sense was to reverse it. Let's go back the other way. And I just felt like if you don't name a goal, you little chance you'll achieve it. I mean, and so let's name the goal. And Drawdown really was about, could we achieve the goal? I didn't know we could or couldn't when we started out. But I wanted to know. I wanted to know where we stood. Is it really game over? I mean, that's what some people believe. But we entered into that sort of as scientists, as researchers, as journalists, with an objective mind to find out.
You mentioned journalism. I saw in one of your earlier press appearances for this book, I believe, on CBS Morning News, with the supermodel Giselle. Is that the first time you've ever shared a stage with a supermodel? I mean, aside from today.
Well, no, my wife is here, so.
Whoa! This is a man who's been married a while. Knows what to say.
Take a look at her.
Anyway, so that day you said, to be serious for a second, you said, look, the science on climate change has been stellar. The communications on climate change has been not, and we're trying to fix that with this book.
Exactly. The science, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I think is the most significant scientific achievement in human history ever. And I just say all praise to the scientists.
What makes it so significant and so impressive?
Because it's worldwide, it's global, it's collaborative. It is a little bit too conservative because it's consensus-based science. Actually, there's no such thing. Science is evidentiary. There's no such thing as consensus science. But so you've always had to kind of parse the assessments and read between the lines and sort of, you know, as an editor, edit out Venezuela, China, you know, Saudi Arabia, etc., and figure out what they're really saying. But putting that aside, the actual underlying science is really extraordinary. And yet, the science, the way it's been communicated, has been, I think, really deleterious to creating a worldwide movement that has brought people together. I think it's actually done quite the opposite. And for several reasons. One is, first of all, it like 2 degrees. Now, really, what does that mean? I mean, Mark has written a great book on it. We know what it means scientifically, but for the rest of the world, 2 degrees centigrade? In fact, here we don't even understand centigrade, but let's put that aside for a minute. And say, well, okay, 2 degrees, you know, what they're saying is that's basically a phase change, a predicted phase change in which we go from one regime to another on the Earth. But what does that mean to most people? What's a phase change, you know? And so it's so abstract and so conceptual. And then other language around it is decarbonization is a word that's being used. Decarbonize, the pathway, deep pathways to decarbonization. What does that mean? It's a negative term, decarbonize, right? But actually, from our point of view, decarbonization is the problem. It's exactly what happened. We took the carbon that was here in the form of coal, gas, and oil, and trees, and deforestation, and bad agricultural techniques, and put it up there. So we decarbonize this sacred place we call Earth. And so that's not a solution. And then you have terms like negative emission. What's a negative emission? Think about it. What's a negative tree? It's nothing. And so we're using language like that to describe drawing carbon back down. We call it positive sequestration, positive carbon. So the language itself from science has been, the lingo, the jargon, has been very well intended as sort of the way people speak in shorthand to each other, and everyone does in the area that they have expertise. But that has not been successful. And then on top of that, the media has taken the science and basically made headlines that are just scare the pee out of you. And so there's been this constancy of fear, of threat, of doom. And as René Lertzman is here, and Paris Van Stoknes and others have pointed out, you take that, mix well with shame or guilt because about your own individual responsibility or inability, in this case, to act and fully make a difference, and you get numbness, you get indifference, you get an internal anger that turns into despair and depression even, and that's where we are. And I think it's about communication. And this whole the festival, what's about art, literature, yes, but underneath all of this, Berkeley Book Festival is about communication, really, really? Because art, if it doesn't communicate, it's not art to you. And same with a good book. What's a good book? You want to turn the page. So that's a good book for you. And it depends on communication. So the climate movement, to me, depends on changing our communication to each other.
That's one of the things that's so striking about the title of this book, Draw Down. It gives you a very visual image of really what we need to do, which is a rather radical policy prescription that we have to draw this stuff out of the atmosphere. I heard Cristiana Figueres, who of course is the was the chairperson of the Paris Accord, and she was speaking at a conference last month, and she said, which I thought was a pretty good communication line, she says, carbon in the atmosphere is not our friend. Carbon in the soil is our friend.
Yeah.
And that's where we need to take it. We need to put it back in the soil.
It's taken 25 years for the IPCC to go there.
Well, she's not IPCC,
I know,
right?
But it took, so, she didn't say it before either.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the IPCC is so focused on technical solutions, and actually it's supposed to really focus on climate change, the impact.
Yeah.
And that's why the headlines have been so, like, whoa, because it keeps studying impact, both current and then predicted. And it's not, and it's good science. But the problem is the way that science has been communicated has been really, you know, here's like, it's been communicated like this, you know, I know the, you know, and it's communicated in headlines that are very, very, you know, sort of startling. And then alongside of that, you know, on the internet, you have clickbait, you know, and you can see the second one that says, you know, woman, you know, murders husband with frog ornament and keeps him mummified for 18 years in a plastic sheeting. And so this idea that somehow these are equal, somehow stories, this is the end of civilization and this is a woman who killed her husband with a frog ornament. And you know, and you go, well, I want to know more about that. There's no click here for the article, you know. And so, the science has been communicated in such a way as to guarantee people that will either pull back from it or click on the debate, you know. I mean, just like a tip for relief. And if you, it's kind of like this. We've been saying to each other over and over and over for the past 10, 20 years, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. It's bad. It's getting worse. It's getting worse faster. Imagine you have a friend and they have, say, second stage cancer of some sort. And then all their friends in their community say, you're sick. And every day say, you're sick. And then a week later say, you're probably sicker because it's cancer. And then everyone around you says, oh, you're sick, you're sick, you're sick. That's what we're doing to ourselves. And it doesn't mean she doesn't or he doesn't have cancer. But that doesn't heal the person.
There's also, I have to say, my own profession is partly culpable here. As someone who's covered climate change for 20 plus years now, there's a strong bias inside of the media, especially the mainstream media, against talking about solutions. It's okay to talk about the problem because that exists, but if you talk about solutions, that's prescriptive, and somehow we're not supposed to do
that. Why is that? Is that because it is?
That is a very good question, and I would say that the main reason for that bias is that it is seen as taking a position, having some kind of a political agenda, which, of course, every piece of news you have ever consumed has an agenda behind it. Whether the person who's reporting it knows what that agenda is or not, there is no such thing as perfectly objective information. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we couldn't have done a much better job than we did. Now, yet another, you mentioned the IPCC. That's, of course, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for those who aren't familiar. And one of the other things that they've been very, very slow on that I see was a happy surprise in your book is there was a focus pretty much for the, certainly through the 90s and the first decade of the century on, if you talked about climate change, you were talking about energy. You were talking about oil, gas, coal. Food, I remember going to Copenhagen in 2009 to cover that climate summit. Food was literally not on the agenda, literally not mentioned. I looked at your list of solutions, and I highly commend this. It's on page 222 of the book, which, if you haven't heard, the book is called Drawdown, first comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. And at the end, there is a listing, kind of a ranking, really, of which solutions do the most in terms of drawing down carbon. Four of the top 10 are related to food or forests, land use, shall we say. 12 of the top 20. And yet, if you look at how this conversation has taken place internationally over the last 25 years, food and forests, forests a little bit, but food almost ignored. So was that a surprise to you guys as you did the research?
Yes. The modeling we did was on two sides, one on carbon. And there's only two things you can do. You can stop putting greenhouse gases up there, and you can bring them back down, bring them home. There's only two things you can do. You can do the first by efficiency, conservation, by renewable energy, substituting out for fossil fuels. And the second one, the only way we really know how to do it in any substantive way is through photosynthesis. And it can be trees and bushes, it can be grass, it can be technologies and techniques and practices on the land, which in fact do bring carbon back home. And so having said that, when we modeled the solutions, all the carbon or greenhouse gas data is based on peer-reviewed science, period. We didn't use beliefs, assertions, contensions, whatever. We just didn't use it, only peer-reviewed. And even then, in some areas where we had a range of science, then we did sensitivity analysis to make sure we used the low median projection. So we always had a bias to the conservative. On the economic side, the same thing. In some cases, we just extended the cost today right out to 2050 as being constant, which of course is not going to happen. In some cases, the way we lower the cost was so conservative. We, again, did that on purpose. And the scaling, every one of the 80 solutions that we did model is in place, hands-on, practical, W.W. Granger, I say, state of the shelf. So, and they're all scaling. In other words, it's not like we ought to do this, or did you know we could, or why aren't people doing more of this?
Yeah, no, it's happening.
It's happening. And the criticism we got, because we are a collaboration, we're not a small group in NGO in South Salido, which we are as staff, but we had 70 researchers from all over the world, 22 countries.
You say 70?
70, yeah. Wow. Six continents, 40% women, half PhDs, all with advanced degrees or more. And we didn't have any money, so we went around the world and asked for people who wanted to be drawdown fellows, and basically they wrote a thesis for $1,000. And they're just the most elegant, wonderful, sweet, amazing people in the world. If you want to have believe in the future, these are the people to meet, I'll tell you. And they did the core research, and we had 120 plus advisors, and then we had 40 outside expert scientific reviewers of the model. So that's what went into Drawdown, and what the consistent criticism was from the advisors and the outside scientific reviewers was they were too conservative.
That you were too conservative.
The numbers are too conservative. And we all grinned ear to ear because that's exactly the criticism we want. The last thing we'd want is somebody to say, oh, you've egged the pudding, you've exaggerated, this is incredible, come on.
In other words, we can do even better.
Oh, yeah. It's so much better. It's astonishing. And we could even see that when we were modeling on the economic side. We were watching costs go down. And, you know, when this, just before it was published, where we could change it, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Bloomberg all came out with pieces at the same time that said onshore wind is now the cheapest, least expensive form of new electrical generation in the world. It's like, oh. I mean, so it just went right by coal and combined cycle gas within the last 12 months, and it isn't stopping. And they predicted solar to be 3-4 years behind that in terms of competitiveness. So when I think of our, you know, I call him President Legume, not President Trump, because I say he has the moral weight of a lentil, so that's my... But when he calls, you know, tries to like push forward the agenda of the fossil fuel industry, it's like, good luck. I mean, really, I mean, he can do terrible damage. And so I'm not trying to diminish that so much, but he can't actually make it happen. I predict here that the fossil fuel industry will collapse by 2030, completely collapse. And for cost. For reasons of cost, it's unaffordable. It's just unaffordable. And between transport and EVs and AVs, autonomous vehicles and so forth, I mean, it's going to be so disruptive, this change. And that's, we're in a phase change on that level too. And they don't see it coming. You know, President Legume can open up every coal seam in the United States and opened up for mining. And there's not one new coal-fired electrical generation plant will be built ever again in the United States. And so I don't know what he's smoking, but it's obviously not working for him. But that is what we saw in the data, which is fossil fuel, I don't know, 10 years, you know, 12 years. I mean, we don't know when, but its death rate is already published.
We're at the Bay Area Books Festival here in Berkeley, California, at Freight and Salvage, talking with Paul Hawken about his book, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. I'm Mark Hertzgard. Paul, you mentioned that argument that you just made. A lot of people, I'm going to just put you on the spot here about the news of the last couple of days, when the President Trump announced the withdrawal from the Paris Accord. Many people were saying that, especially in Europe. The head of the European Union and the president of China met the day after Mr. Trump's announcement, and they said, we're going ahead. New prime minister of France said, we're going ahead, and it is unstoppable. That is the transition to clean energy. And anybody who's been reading the business pages, frankly, would see that coming. But you also mentioned that Trump's agenda can do terrible damage. And so I wonder, as you look at the research that's in Drawdown and its conservative bias, and you said we can do so much better, do you think that 2 degrees target, is that still within reach?
Very much so. But we, just so you understand the difference between what we do, the IPCC is about climate impact. So it's thinking atmospherically, okay? What happens there, and then what's the impact? What does it do here? That's not me. It's back there. Okay, whatever it is. Thank you for sharing. And we measure what's happening on the ground. We measure emissions, and we use a business as usual case from the IEA and the IPCC. We kind of combine them as to what's going to happen over the next, you know, until 2050. And then against that, then we measure what can be done if these solutions continue to scale. So we're measuring against a business as usual scenario. We just don't see, as I said, we just don't see the, I wouldn't call it hope, but the fantasies of the fossil fuel industry or that political wing of America. But at the same time, there's no question that when you have somebody who's basically that narcissistic and illiterate, and as a chief executive officer, then he is subject to the will of Steve Bannon and other people, you know, and fake news he believes and generates, and that, so who knows what decisions he can make, you know. But in terms of affecting the growth and the expansion of these solutions, there's very, very little he can do because they never came from the federal government. And we have to understand the federal government in the United States has never led ever in terms of climate change. Now, did Obama try? Of course. You know, did Clinton try? Of course. Clinton Gore. But they had a Congress very much similar to the one we have now. And so the United States has never been a leader. The fact is that Trump's action actually has galvanized the world to be even more dedicated to this outcome of reversal. And, you know, tell LA about it. Tell San Francisco. Tell Portland. Tell Seattle. Tell Salt Lake City. Tell Chicago. Tell Denver. They're on their way to meeting the Paris Accord. And so I want to start a website called PPA, which is my personal Paris Agreement. So look for it and say, look, this is what I'm going to do. And
Let's drill down into some of the solutions, because you mentioned a number of the cities that are committed to going 100% green. Governor Brown announced literally the same day that Trump announced his withdrawal from Paris. Governor Brown announced that he is creating, along with Governor Cuomo in New York and Governor Inslee in Washington State, a new United States Climate Alliance, and cities will be part of that. A lot of these solutions that you talk about in the book are things, as we've mentioned, that are happening now. How much can they simply be accelerated and advanced by cities and state governments, and how much can they be withheld or delayed by the federal government? You know, Obama did push through a lot of green energy subsidies in that first program in 2009. Is it too late for Trump to stop the advance? Can he slow it down, or can the work at the local and state level overwhelm that?
Definitely he can work at the margins. You know, he talked about reducing or eliminating the production tax credit for wind power, and Chuck Grassley, the Republican senator of Nebraska, famously said, over my dead body. And so the red states there, from North Dakota to Texas, are the wind corridor of America, the best one ever. And you can't make the new wind turbines far away from where they're set up because they're too big. You can't get them there. There's no roads and transport systems that can move them. So you have to make them in the states where there's the most wind. And that's called jobs. And so I think what he's going to run into is that when it gets to a district level, you know, to Congress person level, whether it's a red or blue or purple, they're going to run into real resistance, both on solar, on wind, on storage, you know, on batteries, on EVs, on cars, on you name it. Those people represent whatever they think their ideology is. End of the day, they represent people who vote, and they're not going to be job killers. And so there's no question that, you know, his sentiments may turn one way, but in practice, the United States works pretty venally on the congressional level, you know. And the fact is that, what is it? The report came out like a week ago that, you know, there's 10 million people in the world working on renewable energy now. And
3 million here in the United States.
3 million here, and two times as many people work in solar than in coal. You know, I mean, so It's a different game over, which it's game over for those industries.
Well, let's look, though, and this is a little devil's advocate question, just giving you a heads up here.
We always like the devil.
Yeah. The number one solution in your book is, You know, I've been covering this field a long time. I would not have guessed.
And we either did we.
I'm sure you didn't. I'm not even sure I know how to pronounce it. But it's
refrigerant management.
Refrigerant management. Now, I want you to be honest, everybody. Raise your hand if you can give me a definition of what refrigerant management means.
Come on, raise your hand. Come on.
Okay, there's one. Refrigerant management. So that's the number one, and you're going to tell us about that. But you also say that in that case, most of the solutions that you put forward are so-called no regrets. In other words, even if there was no climate crisis, this makes economic sense.
Yeah.
But in this case, you say the costs are considerable. $903 billion to do this by 2050, or roughly $30 billion a year. So first tell us, what is refrigerant management? And is that the kind of thing that an unsympathetic president in the United States can delay?
I'll work backwards to that one, or no, frontwards, which is refrigerant management is the CFCs and HFCs that are used in air conditioners and refrigerators. They have a global warming potential of 5,000 to 9,000 times CO2. And they, like in the United States alone, 5 billion pounds every year are released into the atmosphere. And what's wonderful about that solution is that even though we did the math, since the book came out, we've been just overwhelmed from the refrigeration industry, which is going, they're so happy. And just, this is what we're doing, and come to our conference and speak to us, you know. And we've done 10,000 supermarkets already and converted them to safe refrigerants, which are ammonia and CO2, either one, by the way. CO2 is the best refrigerant there is.
And you've got to recycle them, right, after their end
use. The thing is, they're in refrigeration systems now, air conditioning systems, and you got to pull them out and then and decommission them. Otherwise, they go up into the atmosphere of the red light.
And who pays for that? Is that the taxpayer? Or
actually, business is paying for it now. This is the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol,
right.
And so the 175 nations agreed in Rwanda last year to phase them all out by 2030, and faster if you're a developed or well-to-do nation, and longer if you don't have much the same income. But the world basically agreed to phase it out and to decommission, and so that's number one. However, it's not really. If you take onshore and offshore wind, and we measured them separately, modeled them separately, because the economics are so different, and so we couldn't conflate them, they're the number one solution. So together, offshore and onshore wind is. However, we could go to the slide if you want. If you take girls' education and family planning, and you put those together, the empowerment of girls and women in the world is the number one solution to global warming.
I want to talk about that a bit. As you know, Paul, I spent a lot of the 1990s traveling around the world to write a book called Earth Odyssey about the environmental future, and had a whole chapter in there on population. And it is a topic that, especially here in the United States, I find many people want to talk about population control, is the word they use, as a solution to the environmental problem. And the funny thing about it is it's like what Abraham Lincoln said about slavery. The people who are in favor of it never want to sign up for it themselves, right? And so population control is always something that is supposed to happen with those people who happen to be not white, who happen to be not wealthy, etc. And I remember in the 90s writing that book and being so struck by, wow, the best thing you can do is have fairness and equality for women and girls. Why, and I want you to talk about why that's the case, but also why you think that has been left off the solutions table for so long.
Well, not to be too genderish here, but because it's a field dominated by men. The science and the communication has been completely dominated by men. And the language around it, again, was interesting. Control problem, right? What does that, who does that sound like? It sounds like my dad, actually. But our language is empowerment and support, because when you empower, you create the conditions in which a young girl can stay in school past puberty, fifth or sixth grade, and finish her education, high school education. She makes very different choices because she's become a woman more on her terms than on the terms of her village, her family, her culture, her religion, which actually kind of all mingle together and force her into an early marriage and reproductive rates, which are in the 5 to 7 range. That girl who is educated makes choices about her reproduction and her family that are around 2, the average around 2. We've known this for 40 years. You knew it in your book. I mean, you wrote about it. But not only that, those children, because she has a higher education, more education, she earns more, she puts more resources into them, there's less poverty, there's better health outcomes. She, her children in turn, you know, do the same thing, which is really 2 children per family woman is basically stability in terms of actually it's actually starts to go down. And family, when we talk about family planning, we're talking about family planning everywhere. We make that very, very clear. This idea that somewhere over there they should have family planning. No, somewhere here we should have family planning. And in Europe and South America, everywhere in the world should have, the women should have access to reproductive support, reproductive health, and reproductive choices.
Some people say the United States is the most overpopulated nation in the world because not only do we have a large population, but our consumption levels are so high. What's your take in drawdown on that dynamic between population and consumption?
Well, Paul Ehrlich did it, IPAT, you know, I mean, you multiply affluence, you know, and times the population, and you get a very different number than just a person. And I think that the good thing about the United States, though, is that it's sort of brilliant in many ways. And I want to go to this side, you know. We have in the book what's called coming attractions. And coming attractions are, we couldn't model them. They're incipient. They're just on the horizon. They're validated scientifically. So it's not that they're fantasies. They are here. But there isn't data sufficient to model them either economically or in terms of carbon. And I have to say, you know, we did the 80 of the extant solutions, you know, the W.W. Granger state of the shelf stuff. But we did 20 in this book, and we're going to do another book, D2, called 60 more of these. And I think what we're trying to do is say, look, with what we have at hand, we can reverse global warming. Okay, and you. The models will all be published fairly soon. It's be open source. You can take a look at it. You can check the math, the references. There's 5,000 references to the model. Okay. And it takes some time to check them all, but you can check them all and so forth. It's all be open source, so you can just determine yourself, you know, whether that's true or not. But what I wanted to convey is that that's not the end. That's not all we have in terms of tools and techniques, that there is coming an extraordinary, imaginative, innovative a series of technologies, of techniques, of practices that just make you grin and smile and say, wow, humans are really on the case. And that's what America does really well. And so it consumes too much, it eats too much, it does a lot of things too much, but it also is brilliant. And I don't want to just let that point go, you know, and not to say that there isn't brilliance happening throughout the world, but in terms of really breaking the ground in this area, I would say, of all places, America is ahead of the rest of the world. And so that's why it's so, what's the word, so, not tragic, but so sad, you know, that we don't have a Congress and an executive that recognizes the brilliance of American humanity, you know,
and science.
And science, oh yeah, absolutely.
We're cutting science.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you spent a lot of your career in business. what would you do if somebody wanted you to cut your science budget? Your research budget, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, it's like cutting off the future. Because research is always about the future and saying, no, we don't need the future.
We're here at the Bay Area Books Festival at Freight and Salvage here in Berkeley, California. We're talking with Paul Hawken. He is the creator and editor of the terrific new book, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming.
Can I say something about the title?
Yes.
Okay. It's a really brash and cheeky title. Okay. The story of the title came from a Stanford intern who was working at Penguin during last summer. Not this one, last summer. And it was the verso, the piece that's supposed to go on the back of the book, describing what the book is for galleys that never happened. And it was sent to me by my editor, and I looked at it going, no. It was not a plan. I told you it wasn't a plan. It was research. But I left it on my desk, that subtitle, and I looked at it, and the more and more I thought, no, it really is. Let me explain. The most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. First of all, no other plan has ever been proposed. So, you know? I mean, so we just...
So you saw your market opportunity.
Yeah. Take the high moral ground on that one, you know, and like the most literate plan, the most nuanced plan, the most whatever. I could say anything I want because there's nothing to compare it to. And in terms of plan, usually you go, whoa, plan, you know, whose plan? Actually, what we're saying is we didn't make the plan. We found it. It's here. It's our collective wisdom. And didn't come from the top. It didn't come from an international agency. It didn't come from a charismatic white male vertebrate. It came from humanity. And sometimes you have to step back, you know, to see us, to see we. And the reason we did it as a collaboration is because we wanted us to talk to us. We wanted people to feel when they looked at the book that it was a we talking to a we. This is what we are doing. This is what we know. And that's why we said it's a plan, but it's not our plan. Not our plan in the sense of our little NGO.
This maybe is a good moment to segue a little bit, since I mentioned that you've spent so much of your career in business. I think many people would maybe perhaps not know about Paul Hawken, that in your youth, you were very involved in the civil rights movement. You and I had occasion recently to talk about that. You were the press secretary for the student non-organized, or was it SNCC, or was it...
I was the press coordinator for the March on Montgomery.
For the March on Montgomery.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that, and can you connect for us the line that brought that young man to this mature man?
That's easy. I was raised and brought up in Berkeley. We called ourselves Berkeley Brats. Our fathers taught at the university. And when I was 14, I'd be at the Mediterranean Cafe on Telegraph, sounding completely pretentious. Can't imagine what I sounded like then. And so going to the South, it was like, well, yeah, you know. And I mean, it wasn't a picnic, I'll tell you that. It was like really shocking.
No, let's be serious for a moment. Those were dangerous days.
Yeah. I mean, I was so naive, you know. I was like a photographer. My father was a photographer. I grew up around Ansel Adams and Minor White and Capa Negro and really great artists. And I was like, I knew how to take pictures. So they would send me out when I worked for CORE in New Orleans. They would send me out to places to take pictures, like Bogalusa. And I remember going to Meridian, Mississippi, where the Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman were both tortured and killed, you know, and buried, and then by the Klan and the sheriff. And John Doerr then, who was at the Justice Department, got an injunction against the Klan that they could no longer march with their hoods. They had to march without their hoods. And so they send in the naive, 17-year-old from Berkeley, said, oh, take pictures of them. And so I tell you, I was like, not so bright in some ways. And
your guardian angels were working
overtime. They were, yeah, because they actually, I remember, like, you know, you walk backwards with the camera, you know, you're taking a picture, and there's all of a sudden this guy came in the frame of the camera going, whoa. And he looked, oh, how can I say this respectfully? There was just a blankness in the eyes, a complete, like IQ between 60 and 70 kind of eyes, you know, just like glass marbles, you know, and with a grin, which was not a good sign. And then all of a sudden I just, you know, and he was about 6'7", really big. And we were dragged into a car, and I said, this is not going well, you know. And taken away by Klan members, you know, and then pulled over right away by another car with the same kind of guys, you know, and they all knew each other, and I thought, this is really getting bad. And these guys were FBI. And they went to high school together and played football, and they knew each other. But he said, you know, John, why are you doing this shit? You know, like, don't do that. You know we can't do that stuff anymore. This is the FBI talking to the Klan. I thought, boy, I'm in the deep south. And so they took me away and took me to jail and arrested me so for disturbing the peace. Yeah.
So you saw at a very young age that justice is not just some abstract ideal, that it involves a fight. There are moments in this book where one gets the sense of, oh, this is happening, this is almost inevitable. But there's a huge justice component to climate, and a huge racial component as well. Speak to that a little bit, and how these solutions, are these solutions, if you will, sort of equal opportunity solutions, in the sense that there is available to us middle class or better Americans as they are to that struggling single mom in Sao Paulo?
What a good question. I think just to tie the last comment to this, the benefit of being in the South at that time was to really experience hate, people who are hateful. And it's given me a lot of understanding about what we see in the world today, how normal, we're all human beings, we all have heart to beat, we care about, you know, children and at least almost everybody. And how does somebody become that hateful and determined to be right and to make others wrong? And so to me, it was very, very helpful in that sense. Now, in terms of these solutions, we modeled it globally. So we didn't model the US or a developed country. We modeled it globally. And of course, in terms of renewable energy, you'd say, well, it's so much easier for a developed country, a well-to-do country, to convert to solar and wind. Actually, it's almost the other way around, because where you have poverty, they can't afford to make, they're buying diesel and kerosene, you know, to keep the lights on. It's really, really expensive. And in remote places where there's no grid at all, and solar becomes really an amazing opening. I'm just showing, I know this is all, I just want to show you something here, which is really, these are solutions. I'm sorry, you people on the radio, but I'll get
it. We'll describe them to you.
Yeah, we'll describe it to you. But this woman, okay.
This is a wonderful picture, for those of you who are on the radio, of a mother with two young children, very colorfully dressed, holding a solar panel in front of a house that is, what, made of, looks like stalks of some kind of bamboo-ish type tree?
Yes, she is an Uru woman in Lake Titicaca who lives on a straw island, and she has to put straw on the island every 90 days in order for the island not to sink. Those are her daughters. She used kerosene on her straw island to keep the illuminate at night so her daughters could study, and now she has a solar panel, and that's why she's grinning from ear to ear, because it's not just light, it is safety, it's a kindness. And so in many respects, the solutions that are being proffered actually lower the cost for people in many parts of the world. This isn't true for every solution, so you can't generalize on all 80. But I do think that in terms of equity or social justice, the most unjust thing in the world is for us who have basically put the plurality of carbon in the atmosphere came from this country, and for us then to be leaders with respect to reversal makes sense, and not only internally, but to doing whatever we can in terms of support, education, technology, to really empower people in the rest of the world. And I hope that's what this book does accomplish in the sense of revealing what we can do, you know, and measuring and modeling it, so it's not just abstractions. And so often, you know, what we hear, and it goes back to something you said very earlier, we hear that the solution to global warming or climate change is solar, wind, solar, Teslas, EVs. We hear it around here anyway. And then don't eat so much meat and don't cut trees. And that we're going to get a hall pass to the 22nd century if we do that. And that's simply a scientific howler. That's just not true. And every one of those solutions is crucial. Absolutely crucial. And so I think that when you see the so-called smaller solutions, which are very much at hand, not just here, but all over the world, and you take into consideration that there's no such thing as a small solution. And there's a tendency in America to focus on, well, what's the top five and what's the top 10, as if the others were, oh, I'm just going to focus on the big ones. Well, yeah, for sure, focus on them, but don't lose your focus on the rest of them. And when it comes to farmland restoration and so many of the land use practices that are there, these are accessible around the world, and they create better income, productivity, better resilience in terms of water, flood, rain, drought. You wrote about such a person. Mark's got an essay in this book. About Jacobo, what's his last name?
Somebody Jacobo
Sawadogo, yeah, which is called The Man Who Stopped the Desert in Burkina Faso. Amazing, amazing piece about an amazing man who basically looked at what was happening because of the depredations of climate change, less rain, that's basically it, and started to, because the rain would sheet off the hard pan, that soil, and so he built little curlicues, stones, you know, that went in S curves,
little troughs.
Troughs, yeah. And in the middle of the, that was a termite hole. So the water would go down the termite hole, and down the termite hole were seeds, and trees came up, and then he became basically by sort of accident a silver pastoralist or silviculture or a tree intercropper. He grew his same millet and other crops, but now the trees were growing. And what happens is what we know now, and he discovered, is that trees not only hold water, but actually they fertilize. They're fertilizers. And there's another great essay by Jeanine Benyus at the end of this called Reciprocity. And she describes here in California how the UC Davis and everybody was recommending take out the blue oaks in the foothills because it's going to impinge upon, you know, your cattle or sheep and so forth, and you have more grass if you get rid of these beautiful old blue oaks. And the fact is it went the other way, of course. And there was one scientist who basically put, you know, studied these oaks and put little bags, you know, underneath them to collect the rainwater and then measure the minerals in the rainwater, and discovered that the area around a blue oak was 10 to 60 times more intense in terms of minerals because the roots of the oak trees were bringing them up and into the leaves and the rain, and they were leaching out. And those are the blue oaks were fertilizing the foothills. And so I just think that when you look at these solutions and you look, what's so beautiful about him is observational science. He was there. He knew his place. And we still
have... And he was a risk taker, Paul, which a lot of his neighbors were not.
Yeah, that's true. He was a risk taker. He let the trees grow. Everyone said, take them out. You know, they're parasitic. And he let them grow. And what I'm trying to say here is that the people really know what to do if... we respect and listen to them as opposed to, oh, we know what to do in the West, you know, and they've got these top-down solutions. And it's really also about listening to those people. And that's why that article and essay is so beautiful to me and why we published it in Dwada.
So we're going to go to questions from the audience. I'm going to ask Paul one more, but those of you who do want to ask questions, do get ready. We're coming towards the end of the session, but we have time to hear from all of you. Not all of you, but we're happy to listen to some of you, as many as we can fit in. And I'll ask you, of course, to make it a question, not a speech, not a comment even. A question, please.
This is Berkeley, so you have to really watch yourselves.
Yeah. And, and this is the radio, so we do need to keep it moving a little bit. But so as you get ready for that, Paul, I just want to ask one last question here, which is kind of the theory of social change behind the book. There's all these incredible solutions. You've laid it out in a very comprehensive and, I think, accessible way. What's the strategy for how it spreads so that people who are at whatever level of society, in whatever country they find themselves in, how can they apply this stuff and really push this action forward?
Well, first of all, the answer to that question is I don't know. And if I did answer it, you should run, because that would intimate a comprehensive knowledge of the world that I don't have, and cultures in place, and economies, you know, I don't know. However, having said that, what we are finding is that it's being pulled in. And one of the biggest pulls is the Commonwealth of Nations, 52 countries, 2.4 billion people, between the fifth and the fourth of the world's landmass, the former British Commonwealth. And they have adopted Drawdown as the template for what they call RDRCC, which is Regenerative Development Through Reversing Climate Change. And I was in London 2 weeks ago addressing the 52 high commissioners of these countries, about RDRCC, and they will announce this publicly at CHOGM, which is the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in April 2018 with the Queen Elizabeth and Prince Charles. And the neat thing about the Commonwealth is that they have common law, because they're all British territories at one time. They have common law. The way they change the law is to collaborate. And it's like, they are actually the true United Nations in this world. The United Nations is the divided nations. And they have people who can veto things arbitrarily, you know, and like us and Russians and the Chinese and so forth, you know. So Chinese? I'm not sure Chinese. But yeah, now they can. But the point being is they work together. They listen. They work to see what works. And they have so many low-lying, vulnerable island nations. And one of them is the president of COP23. So he's going to introduce it in October in Bonn, where COP23 is. And then it'll be announced. He's going to introduce regenerative development.
And who is he again? Which president?
Bainimarama is his name.
Of but what nation?
Fiji. I'm sorry, Fiji. Fiji is a host country, but they don't have room, so they're doing it in Germany. And but they're still the host country, and so he's in his opening speech. So this is, we're seeing Drawdown being pulled in, as opposed to saying, well, we know this is what you ought and should or could do. I'm not sure. And that's what I love about having this as an offering as opposed to a tell.
So if you do have a question, I want you to raise your hand. There will be microphones coming around. So come forward, and I'll let you, the person with the microphone. And while we're doing that, I'll just remind everyone, we are here at the Bay Area Books Festival in Berkeley, California, at Freight and Salvage. I'm Mark Hertzgard with The Nation magazine, and we are discussing the book Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, with the editor, Paul Hawken. Go ahead.
I'd like you to talk about synergy between some of these solutions. For example, I was just on the Klamath River, the Yurok Reservation. They're restoring cultural burning for basketry, to protect from catastrophic fire, to open the forest for food, to release water into the rivers. And I'm supposing that although you list your solutions separately, there are synergies in which a number of them are more than the sum of the parts.
Yes, that's quite correct. That's absolutely true. We call them system dynamics, which is, you know, it's not a Bucky Fuller word for it, but it's the same identification of the interrelationship between the solutions. If we had modeled them as siloed solutions, it would have been easy and wrong. And the reason it took us so long, we didn't have the data ourselves until February 1st. We didn't know refrigerant management would come out number one. We were shocked and not actually entirely pleased either, by the way. We thought, that's not very sexy at all. But we had to stick to the numbers. And the reason it took so long is because of system dynamics, that these solutions play upon each other in ways that are actually extraordinarily complex. So you take girls' education, that has a big effect on deforestation, or the lack of it. We didn't include that, by the way. We actually used very low numbers for girls' education and family planning, because we knew when we combined them, we'd be number one, and we wanted somebody to criticize us and say, actually, the numbers are low. They're higher. But the models themselves are distinct, and then when you start to interlink them, you start to discover these relationships, which have to be taken into consideration. More EVs, where is electricity going to come from? Are you modeling an increase in renewable industry or now energy, or are you in fact leaving the coal-fired plants unshuttered and still working in order to supply the sudden increase in EVs? So, yeah, it's very complicated, and that's why we loved it so much too, because it's so much fun.
Okay, and I see the microphone is moving there to the back. Here we go.
Hi. You mentioned earlier coming attractions, and I'm wondering if you could share a couple of those with us.
Sure. One of them is marine permaculture, which is 1 square kilometer frames built of recycled PET, which doesn't break down in salt water, and pumps that go down to the thermoclines, pumps that are actuated just by the rise and fall of the water. And they bring up the cold nutrient-laden waters up into these frames, and you get a kind of trophic cascade of phytoplankton, zooplankton, algae, kelp, feeder fish, forage fish, etc., within weeks. And basically, kelp is the fastest way to sequester carbon. You produce protein. You deacidify the ocean where they are. And basically, 99% of the tropical oceans are marine deserts. There's no life there at all. And so you're bringing life back to the ocean. Global warming, the 97% of the heat is going into the waters, oceans, not land. Only 3% goes to the land. And so what that's doing is creating these heat blankets, if you will, thermal blankets in the ocean, which is preventing the traditional or the circulation patterns in the ocean. And that's what happened in California the last 2 years. You know, we had the big die-off in the pinniped population was they were starving because there wasn't food. And so what marine permaculture does is reverse that and sort of, you know, jump start it. And they did it off Hawaii, the north of Hawaii, and within weeks they had I'm blanking now. I finally what's the vegetarian shark? Come on. The vegetarian shark. Huh? Whale sharks. Thank you so much. They had whale sharks swimming around the frames because they're eating the kelp. And just within weeks, this happened in an area which there was no fish whatsoever, much less whale sharks. That's one of the solutions, and one of them is called A Cow Walks Onto a Beach. And this is, you're supposed to laugh, I named it. And this is Joe Dorgan, the farmer in Prince Edward Island, who noticed that his dairy cows that ate seaweed produced more milk, and the question is why. And he asked around, and the county agent said, you should talk to this scientist, Rob Fairley. He did, and said, well, it must be because they're producing less methane, which is a very inefficient metabolic process in ruminants, cows, sheep, and goats. And so they did a study and sort of separated the herd and fed them kelp that they dragged off from the beach. His farm was adjacent to the water, and put plastic bags over their head and then measured the emissions, and sure enough, methane emissions had been reduced 12%. But it wasn't practical. Who's going to drag seaweed onto the beach and feed cows or cattle or in CAFOs, confined area feeding areas and operations? So that scientist met a scientist in Australia who was working on the same possibility, and they went about testing different marine algae and seaweeds. They found one called Asparagopsis taxiformis, which, if fed to ruminants in a 2% quantity, reduces methane emissions by 70 to 90%. And the marine permaculture guy, Dr. Brian Van Herzen, and the Asparagopsis taxiformis people are now forming a business to grow Asparagopsis taxiformis on the marine permaculture frames around the world to feed to sheep, cattle, cows, and goats.
So you have your stock investment tip here for the day as well. We've got time for just a few more. Why don't you, this woman here on the aisle has been waiting, and then there's a gentleman, I think it's a gentleman, can't quite see in the light, so yeah, right in the middle in front of the soundboard.
Thank you. I was wondering how you would answer our governor, who has in many ways played a laudable role in the fight for climate conservation. And when he says he has to allow fracking with some regulation because people want to drive their cars, and so better to produce it here than to import it from other areas. So what kind of answer can the climate movement give to that to help him say, okay, if we, you know, we can ban fracking? What can we do to persuade him to do that?
Well, I used to work for him, and so I have no idea what I would say to him, because I know him well enough to know that he's a Jesuit, and he makes up his mind, and that's it. and I actually really don't know what I'd say to Governor Brown, except, you know, I don't think that's true, you know, that is to say that we need natural gas. But I really don't have an answer to that question, because it's so hypothetical, and then I don't try to convince people, I try to inform, which is a little bit different. And so I wouldn't try to convince him, but if he asked me the question, I would certainly bring out data and say, you know, actually, you can. But he comes from an oil and gas family, you know that. So that's where he made all, the Browns made all their money from oil wells and stuff in Indonesia. So he does know a lot about hydrocarbons.
Yes, and fracking here in California is fracking for oil. It's not for gas. It's mainly, and so far there's not been a lot of it because it hasn't been successful. It's a fight over really about the future of energy policy here, and his argument is that, as you say, that look, we have 35 million Californians, and we Californians drive as much as anyone, and I'd rather get the oil here than from elsewhere. So at some point, we've got to be changing that. But I will say that with the governor and the legislature recently, about a year and a half ago, essentially they put through a bill that snuck right past the oil lobby that essentially is going to electrify transportation in this state. And in fact, I wrote a piece for Business Week magazine, and they gave it, I thought, a great headline, Big Electric Shocks Big Oil. Anyway, we have time for one or two more, and there it is.
Yes, thank you so much. This is what I'm dedicating my life to. I've been planting trees for years, but I'm using Joanna Macy's framework around Gaian structures, holding actions, and our third is shifts in consciousness. So Daniel Pinchbeck's new book, How Soon Is Now, says from personal initiation to global transformation. And I would wonder if you could comment on what's the shift in consciousness that is needed for people to actually feel motivated to care for world as lover, world as self, as Joanna says it.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, I want to be really, I kind of call that a Wizard of Oz question, as if I knew what would be the pathway for personal transformation for an individual, and I don't. I still work on my own. And I'm not trying to, I think it's really more of a statement. It's an excellent question. It's an excellent point, by the way. And Joanna is one of our advisors, and I listen to her keenly. But I do think that when a question like that, I mean, who am I to say? I mean, just here in this room, how different we all are and what our pathways are to global transformation from personal transformation. And I just thank you for the question, but I don't want to overstep. Thank you.
And there's one more question over here. The young lady in the fourth row, and then in the second row, if we have time. And then I saw one more back there. We've got about 4 minutes, so let's try to be...
Hello. Does this work? Okay. So first, will you send my copy of the book? And second, so I'm a young person. I'm like 19, and the average age in this room seems to be at least twice that. So
thank you for mentioning that.
Who's just starting out, because I really care a lot about climate change, and I want to do something, like everything that I can to fight it. What advice do you have for someone who's just starting out in this field?
My advice, first of all, is to stop fighting it. And don't think in those terms. It's not a fight. The terminology around, as I said earlier, about climate change has been to fight, combat, stop, you know, to using these sort of terms of violence. And this is not a violent, this is not about violence. It's about alignment with biology and aligning it with the physics and chemistry of the atmosphere. And along with that, actually, is to think about language. In other words, not how to oppose, but how to create a broader movement. And too much of the emphasis has been on the I. What can I do? What can you? What can you do? What can you do? What can you do? What can you do? And in a sense, instead of we, in order for us to be a we have to change our language and listen and bring people in, because I feel like what we've done is go in a locked back door to humanity. And that locked back door is scientific jargon, lingo, and war metaphors. And the front door is based on what human beings need. And it's been said again and again that the human brain isn't set up to handle something that far out that they can't experience in real time. And I would say to that, let's go to where the human brain works instead of bemoaning the fact that it works some other way. And the way you do that is, whether it's in the Commonwealth of Nations or whether it's here in Berkeley or elsewhere, is what do people need? And what they need is they need jobs. They need jobs that give them a sense of self-worth and value, that are dignified, that are family wage. They need security. They need to do things that actually make a difference, and they feel they're making a difference in the life. And what's interesting about these solutions, not by design, but by, in a sense, looking at them, is that almost every one of them, there's a few exceptions, do that. And we're in a world where we're the only species without full employment. Think about that. Only one. Every other species is at work and singing too, on the branches and having a good time and playing. And so really the what to do is to figure out, why is that so? And when you, never has there been so much work to do, good work to do on the planet than today. And so what is that transformation? How can we go to that point where regenerative development is, of course, and what we saw in the numbers here is actually the cost of the solutions now is less than the cost of the problems. And that wasn't always true. Or you could put it this way, the profit we could make from creating the problem was much greater than the profit from the solutions. That worm has turned in the last few years. And so I feel like we've crossed a watershed that we don't talk about and haven't recognized, but it's in the numbers. And in those numbers is a plan, is a way for humanity to not just regenerate economically, but ecologically, but also to regenerate the atmosphere in that sense, but also to transform our identity of what it means to be a human being at this time on Earth.
I want to we've come to the end of our time here, but just as a tag onto that last question, which I thought was so good, I want to read what Paul writes here in the closing pages of the book, and you mentioned opening, and the closing passage here is titled An Opening. And you say there, and you're talking about our mutual friend and colleague, Bill McKibben, who's done so much to educate everyone about this issue. You say it would be easy for McKibben to exhort us to do more as individuals, but that is not what he recommends. The problem, he writes, is with the very pronoun I. And then you go on to say, what individuals can do is become a movement. A we. Become a movement. It is very difficult to think that, oh, if I eat less meat or if I don't drive a car, that is going to change a problem as big as this. But when you become a movement and you join with other people, that can create big changes. And Bill McKibben has done that with 350.org. And at the end here, Paul writes, this is why in creating Drawdown, we sought to do more than merely perform exacting research and to inform people. We wanted to captivate and surprise, to present solutions in a new way, with an eye towards helping draw the threads and webs of humanity into a more coherent network of people that can accelerate progress towards reversing climate change. Reversing climate change. Thank you all for being with us. We have been here. We're, of course, at the Bay Area Books Festival in Berkeley, California, and we have been talking about the book Drawdown with Paul Hawken, the editor. Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. Will you thank him once again for his work?
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.